I distinctly remember talking to someone, I don't know who it was, several years ago. Now, this seems like ancient history, but it really just happened. The Episcopal Church USA elected and consecrated its first openly gay bishop. You remember that, Gene Robinson, in New Hampshire. Talking to someone right about that time, they said, well, look, this is just a blip on the radar. This is not a big event, and this is not going to have the far-reaching consequences that everyone thinks it's going to have. This is 2 years from now. It'll be all a matter of course, and we will have gone on. Life will have simply moved forward after this event in the Episcopal Church USA. Well, that has not turned out to be true. In fact, one controversy spins off another, and we're going to be talking here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., about a dispute still going on in the Anglican Communion and the Episcopal Church USA, not directly, but very solidly and indirectly related to that event a couple years ago, the consecration of Gene Robinson. It has to do with bishops crossing their jurisdictional lines in order to serve parishes, priests, and parishioners in the Episcopal Church USA, sometimes even crossing national boundaries as well. Here in the first 25 minutes, Bishop Keith Ackerman will be our guest. He's a bishop for the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois. And then in the second half hour, we're going to hear a report by the U.S. about a report from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And we'll hear from Muslim leaders about an alleged increase in bias and discrimination against Muslims. There in the second 25 minutes of the program, the theme will be roughly religious liberty, religious freedom. It's open lines for your questions and your comments. Our phone number, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. That's the first hour, but we've barely scratched the surface of the guests and the subjects we'll be covering today, Thursday on Issues, Etc. You know the story of Balaam's jackass. Stories more of Balaam and the people of Israel, but the donkey plays a significant role in that Old Testament story. We'll talk about it with Pastor George Borgart. Then, Pastor Clement Preuss, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, will join us to talk about worship in the church. I've got a question for him up front, and that is, if you look at the book, it says Lutheran Theology in Practice. My daughter saw it sitting in the car the other day. She said, The Fire and the Staff, what's it about? Because at first glance, the title doesn't seem to tell you. Well, it does, and we'll find out why from Pastor Preuss there as we start our second hour of the program. Then we'll be talking with Greg Kokel. Greg joins us to talk about one of his favorite subjects, relativism. How do you respond to the spirit of the age? The three different kinds of relativism, legal, moral. I can't remember what the third one was. We'll have to ask Greg when we get him on. Then finally, Dr. Angus Manoos joins us in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. We're going to be talking about the intelligent design debate in Kansas, and it's not isolated to Kansas. Pennsylvania and several other states are also dealing with this whole issue of the teaching of evolution versus intelligent design in their schools. That's the lineup for today's Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Bishop Keith Ackerman is Bishop of the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois. Bishop, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to hear your voice, and it is superb to hear all these marvelous subjects that you're handling.
This is my everyday existence here on this program.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll tell you what. I'd like to be invited into that realm for just a while.
Well, you have been, and it's to talk about something that is indirectly related to the dispute that's been going on in the Episcopal Church USA for a couple of years now. But tell us how these two things are related. The election and consecration of Gene Robinson some time back, and this dispute over bishops and their jurisdiction.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. Thanks so much for the opportunity. First of all, I think that we have to deal with some premises, some basic issues. And the first one is, A, do we believe that the Word of God is in fact that what God has revealed to us is complete? Or do we believe in some sort of progressive concept which, in effect, says that each generation is much brighter than the previous one, and God is very blessed in having a brighter generation today who finally figure out the things that he couldn't reveal through his son? That, of course, by the way, is pretty much what the Unification Church teaches, that when the Reverend Sun Myung-Moon came along, he was able to complete the work that our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ could not complete. Now, there's another point, and that is that many Episcopalians think of themselves as being members of a national denomination. And so a lot of the things that are going on right now in the Episcopal Church, if this were a national denomination, then I guess it would be translated out as might makes right, even though I might disagree. I would obviously disagree with that. But also, the other part is that given a democracy, to a large extent, we become mesmerized into thinking that we can vote on anything. Well, the rest of the Anglican world doesn't think so. To put it differently, there's only three places in the whole world where our church is called Episcopal. This just happens to be one of them in the States. And we are a shrinking province. We are, in fact, a province of the worldwide Anglican Communion. So what we do in this country affects people who live in the largest and most rapidly growing province, Nigeria. And so what is, in effect, happening is that those large, rapidly growing provinces look at our shrinking province and say, with all these novelties that you've adopted, why aren't you growing? And moreover, what you've done is contrary to what we've agreed upon. You're breaking your promises and you're breaking your agreements. So to say that it's just the Gene Robinson consecration in isolation would be not to look at the whole picture. It's a whole attitude that has to be addressed.
So Gene Robinson, that incident, as big as it was merely a symptom of an underlying problem that's probably even bigger.
Oh, yeah, okay. Absolutely. And, and once again, it's scriptural. It's a matter of what we understand authority to be. And it's also, are we part of the worldwide Anglican Communion or not?
So what have bishops been doing? We talked some time back to a priest who had been ousted by his bishop. This was down south, I think, Georgia someplace. And he then, after being ousted from his parish by his resident bishop, was reinstated with a license to preach by a bishop coming in from one of the African countries who was happy to say, no, I will license you to preach and administer the sacraments elsewhere in the United States. That apparently was a breach of protocol in some way.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I have been listening to the debate and participating in the debate that some of the bishops on the left have put forward about somehow equating boundary crossing with the behavior that's been going on in the Episcopal Church for the last 30 years as it relates to novel introductions to the faith. First of all, it's very clear the primates do not see them as the same. Second of all, that very small section that talks about crossing boundaries that's mentioned in both the Windsor Report and the communique, and now in that which has been put forward by the Archbishop of Canterbury, is the one small section that many on the left are picking out as being the essence. The reality is that that is not the essence of the communication. That is, in fact, one very small point, which in effect says if the left will stop pushing the button, if the left will stop testing the borders and boundaries and stop violating the agreements that we have with it, then we would also ask the right not to cross borders. But you see, it's a bit like the child who only hears one half of the parent's statement.
So what is it that is, what situation has prevailed in some places in the American branch of the Anglican Communion that has compelled bishops by conscience to cross jurisdictional boundaries?
Well, it's partly a principle, but I guess I should preface it by saying there are 37 distinct groups that have broken away from the Episcopal Church. And when I say distinct groups, I mean distinct Anglican denominations, if you will, none of which are in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. The definition of being an Anglican is to be in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury, the See of Canterbury, which we believe to be an historic see that's descended from the first Archbishop of Canterbury, namely St. Augustine, who was sent to England by the Bishop of Rome to be primate of this unsettled territory, as he thought, and discovered later that Christianity was actually alive and well there. However, what has happened with these 37 distinct bodies is many of them would love to be in communion with the See of Canterbury, but they don't want to be in communion with the Episcopal Church. That is, they'd love to be in communion with the archbishops in Nigeria. So the question is, what do we do with these 37 distinct groups that are now all over the country, A? B, what do we do with another distinct group called the Anglican Mission in America, which is made up of American bishops who have been consecrated by bishops in Anglican dioceses overseas and sent here to be able to take care of those churches which are either being ousted or at odds with their bishop? And now what do we do about the fact that Nigeria says, well, you know what, our people are complaining that they can't find a church that even seems like the church that they know, so we're establishing a Nigerian branch in the United States. Rather than saying, why is it that things are this bad, that this is necessary, the response seems to be more like, how dare you?
The headline reads, Anglicans will look at disputes over bishops. Picture of Rowan Williams, the titular head, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of the Anglican Communion. He's calling for this panel to look into that issue, it appears, among other issues as well. What's your reaction to this action on the part of the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Well, I was just with him 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to meet him again in about 3 weeks. And I can tell you all of our conversations have been very upbeat and positive. And I can tell you what he would probably do is laugh at that and say, well, they picked out one small part and made that the headline.
Mm. So what is this panel? Is this panel to look into other issues?
The panel of reference is supposed to look into all violations. And it was set up by the primus, who are appalled at the fact that there are priests being disciplined in this country for their orthodoxy. So that panel reference is set up to look at everything that was discussed in both the communique that was issued by the primates recently and also the Windsor report that was put out well in advance of the communique, both of which were necessitated by the crisis in the Episcopal Church and in the Church in Canada. That is to say, our 2003 General Convention only brought to the forefront much of what had been fomenting prior to that, and it's an unhappy set of circumstances.
We're talking with Bishop Keith Ackerman. He's Bishop of the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois, about a panel formed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, to examine, among other things, the dispute over bishops in the Anglican Communion. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bishop Frank Griswold, who's the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, is quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story from the Associated Press as thinking this panel is a splendid idea, and then the story goes on to say Griswold repeatedly has said he is committed to providing alternative pastoral care for Episcopalians of differing views. Has that borne out true from your perspective?
On a very minimal level. There was something, what had been asked for, not only by the primates, but also by many Americans, was alternative oversight. And this would have been consistent with what the Church of England has done over disputes in the Church of England, where over 1,000 Anglican priests entered the Roman Catholic Church. We lost a number of excellent leaders and a number of scholars in the Church of England. Deal with that dilemma, the Parliament and the Church of England set up something called the Provincial Episcopal Visitor System, which meant that parishes could have bishops who would offer alternative oversight. The American Church has consistently rejected that concept and allows bishops occasionally to come into certain dioceses, but if the bishop doesn't want another bishop coming into his diocese, he says, no, you may not come. And in some instances may say, Bishop A can come, but Bishop B can't. No sacramental certainty for those parishes, which has resulted in a massive amount of money lost due to lawsuits.
What I'm struck by here, Bishop, is that in all of the press reports that you read regarding the recent goings-on in the Episcopal Church USA, it is those like Griswold or Gene Robinson who have been saying, look, we're all about a big umbrella. No one needs to leave. We're all about tolerating all viewpoints here in the Episcopal Church USA. But in fact, it sounds like in practice, tolerance for Orthodox viewpoints or for the actions of more Orthodox bishops, confirmations, ordinations, and the like, is not exactly up to their claim.
If I accepted every invitation to go into other dioceses to do confirmations, that would be a full-time job.
Wow.
And I can't do that. First of all, I don't cross borders. I respect the canons. But second of all, I have to bid fond farewell to many friends who have now left because they are in dioceses where there is no space given to them. And so as a result, they become yet another continuing church, or they join a denomination, or they become a Roman Catholic. Or there's even in the Antiochian church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, an office that just processes all the former Episcopalians. It's that big.
So where do you see the future of the Episcopal Church USA as a quasi-denomination going? And do you see, I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't already know, that Anglicans are renowned for their patience.
Yeah.
And sometimes patience to a fault, to my way of looking at it. Do you see there being a future real communion between what I can only call an erring branch of the church with 77 million other Anglicans worldwide?
I think it is very possible that unless the Episcopal Church does exactly what it's been asked to do in both the Windsor Report and the communique, and that is to apologize to the rest of the Anglican communion for the chaos that it's caused, unless that occurs, I'm rather convinced that the majority of the primates are simply not going to recognize much of the Episcopal Church as being an authentic part of the Anglican Communion, and that would, of course, mean ultimate separation. Do I want to see that happen? Of course not. I'm a cradle Episcopalian, as were my parents and grandparents and all the way back. I don't want that to happen. But, you know, if I thought that I did something to create chaos, if I thought that my actions had done something to break another person's heart, if I thought that my actions even put into peril some of the people overseas who are now in awkward positions because of shifting understandings of morality, I think I'd be very sorry, and I think I'd want to express that sorrow. And I guess that saying that I'm sorry you took it that way is not good enough.
Is that, in effect, I mean, after the Windsor Report, there was kind of that quasi-apology.
Mm-hmm.
We're sorry that we hurt you. We're sorry that you were offended by what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Does that meet what the primates called for?
No. No, it simply did not. As a matter of fact, I've read the responses of five primates now who say that's not even a good beginning. And so, you see, the whole matter you mentioned, patience, is oftentimes not understood in our American culture, but many in the global South think that they must go the biblical route, thanks be to God, as it relates to resolving disputes. And they follow that. First, you go to the person. Then you take a witness. Then you take it to the church. And if that doesn't work, then you shake the dust off your feet. And so they take that so seriously that I'm afraid that sometimes in the Western world, we assume that steps one and steps two are just polite.
Now, on the issue, I think, of homosexual marriage, Rowan Williams was known before his consecration as Archbishop of Canterbury mm-hmm. to have performed one or two. I can't remember exactly. It was somewhere in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. I remember this. Although he did say when he was elevated that he would abide by the will of the church rather than his own personal views. Do you have any indication of what his mind is on the future of the American church?
He will abide by what the Lambeth Conference has agreed upon. You see, what is partly at issue here is that the Lambeth Conference in 1998 said adamantly that it would not do anything that even was close to this. And so anybody who has violated that since the Lambeth Conference has simply violated an understanding. That's what the rest of the Anglican world is upset about. How can we trust you if you say you agree to this and then you go home and do absolutely the opposite? And so Rowan Williams does not want, from a pragmatic perspective, the ship to sink during his watch, for one thing. But at the same time, knowing him as I do, my grandparents and are from the same town he's from in Wales, and I've known him for many years. He's a scholar. And what he has done is he has put before people from time to time a kind of academic exercise, a thesis, an antithesis, a synthesis, as if he's dealing with a classroom. And in some places that works really well, but we understand that that's not a practical way to run a church. And now that he is the Archbishop of Canterbury, he recognizes that these kind of dialectical arguments aren't going to be helpful. And he's a man of the church, and he's going to be obedient to that.
So then what do you make, with only about a minute here, what do you make of those in America who have felt conscience-bound to, well, distinguish themselves in their communion from the Episcopal Church USA? Whether they say they left us or we are leaving them is really immaterial, but what do you make of those who have gone off to form what they consider to be now separate groups from the Episcopal Church USA?
I feel nothing but sorrow, because to a large extent, it's the Anglo-Catholic and the evangelical wing of the church. And so what that means is a great deal of that phenomenal fervor, a sense of transcendence, a sense of urgency in the Word and the sacraments is now lost, and that breaks my heart. And I stay in, first of all, because I believe I've made vows to do that, but second of all, because until they turn out the lights, I want to be a part of the bridge building and make the difference if I can in any conceivable way. So that's the difficulty that that's the difficulty that I'm currently involved in, and that's why I stay, and that's why I work at this. And I feel sorrow, and I wish they'd come. Half of my graduating class has left the Episcopal Church.
You understand why they have?
Oh, yes, I do. It's all over innovations that are inconsistent with the rest of the Anglican world.
Then are we looking at analogous to something like a pot of soup here, and the more that the Orthodox element is boiled away by controversies like homosexuality within the priesthood and same-sex marriage and things like that, boiled off into the surrounding atmosphere, the more concentrated in the liberal element the Episcopal Church USA will become over time?
I believe that's inevitable.
What is the future direction of such a church with only about 15 seconds?
Well, I think that it'll be under the mercy of God. That is to say, in all things, we have to cast ourselves totally on the mercy of Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. And I think that that would mean a very dark day for the church that is cut off from the rest of the world. I think it would be a very dark day, and I think that those who will benefit greatly will be the attorneys.
Hmm. Bishop Keith Ackerman, Bishop of the Diocese of Quincy in Illinois, thank you for being our guest.
Absolutely. God bless you.
And you as well.
Thanks.
When we come back from this break, religious freedom is the general theme for 25 minutes of Open Lines. We're going to be hearing about a report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And then, in a related sense, we'll also hear from a Muslim leader about an alleged increase in bias and discrimination against Muslims. That audio to share with you when we come back from this break. And your questions, your comments, and your reaction, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The theology of the Reformation was originally forged in answer to the errors of the Church of Rome. Today, however, that theology is being challenged not so much by Roman errors, but by Protestant errors. What are those challenges? And how can Reformation theology today be kept from slipping into pop American Protestantism? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, by Pastor Clement Preuss, answers these questions and these challenges in a lively, articulate, and timely way. You can find out all about The Fire and the Staff by Pastor Clement Preuss by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Or to order the book for $26.99, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff.
If you're a marriage and family counselor with a passion for God's glory to be displayed among the nations, God may use you to launch a rewarding new ministry right across our southern border. This Global Minute explores ways to use different God-given abilities in Mexico. A marriage and family counselor could provide a listening ear and pray for couples in trouble. Whether it's counseling abused children, providing health care, or being an executive assistant so mission operations run more smoothly, opportunities await to display God's glory among the poorest of the poor in Mexico. Action International Ministries shares the need for people with a heart for the Lord to go address the deep spiritual bankruptcy of people without Christ in Mexico. Pray the Lord will provide the 22 additional missionaries sought to help reap in this harvest field, home to 100 million people. Find out more with a visit to www.actionintl.org. actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Scott Shim, Matthew Grossman, and Ryan Lightbody have invented a bike that starts out as a three-wheeler, but turns into a two-wheeler as you pick up speed. It'll be a great way for children to learn how to ride. The common thing, said Shim, was looking back to see if your dad is holding your seat and having that fear of crashing or falling all the time you're riding. Boy, can I relate to that. Early 1950s, Ashland Avenue in Chicago Heights. Santa had brought a shiny new Schwinn, and now Father was teaching me how to ride it. One day we head north on the sidewalk, Dad steadying me by holding the back of the seat. Five houses up the street, I look back to make sure Dad is still with me. He's not! I was near the spot where the sidewalk ended, and there was a pile of gravel. I panicked and crashed right onto that gravel pile. These days, many parents are congratulating their children for graduating from college. So those graduates will soon be loading up the car and going solo into life. Dad, Mom, let them go. Let them learn how to ride on their own. And as you watch them go, pray to their real Father, the Heavenly Father, to go with them all the way. He will.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton inviting you to wake up with Word and Song. Mornings on AM 850 KFUO. You'll hear inspirational Christian favorites from folks like Avalon, Mercy Me, and Bebo Norman. Messages from the hosts of Front Porch Parenting, The Meyer Minute, and Creation Moment. Conversations with Dr. Jack Fiennes, Ruth Cook, Dr. Bob Weiss, Jane Wilkie, and Marty Linfett. And devotionals from Pastors Mark Hawkinson, John Schmidtke, and even St. Peter. Start your day with Jesus in your heart and His Word on your mind on AM 850 KFUO.
You know, we just came off that conversation with Bishop Ackerman talking about the troubles in the Episcopal Church USA and the broader Anglican Communion. We've had guests to say it all started in 1976 when the first deviation from, well, the first official practice, of major practice, deviated from Holy Writ, that is the ordination of women in the Episcopal Church USA. So someone asks, if not the ordination of women, what role do women play in the church? Ah, we got a great answer for that. Coming up tomorrow on Issues, Etc., Dr. Arthur Jest of Concordia Theological Seminary is our guest as we talk about the office of deaconess with him. Do not miss it. It's very enlightening. For the rest of today, we're going to be talking here about some religious freedom issues, hearing some audio, a report from the International Religious Freedom U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and then some other issues regarding religious freedom here for 25 minutes. It's open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Other than being one of the most interesting stories in the Old Testament, what can we learn from the story of Balaam and his donkey? Pastor George Borghardt will be our guest. Coming up in about 25 minutes, Pastor Clement Preuss joins us to talk about worship. He's author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff. Greg Kokel will be alongside a little bit later to talk about relativism and how to respond to the rampant relativism in the culture and in the modern mindset. Dr. Angus Manoj also will round off today's program with us as our guest as we discuss the intelligent design debate in Kansas in the school systems of several states. That's the lineup for the rest of the day. Now, religious freedom is a very important issue. we tend to get real worried here in the United States and in the West in general that our religious freedom is being impinged upon when, what? We can't put a nativity scene at the local public library or courthouse. We are very quick to say our religious freedom is being impinged upon. Now, you can put one on your front step, your porch, top of your car, wherever you'd like to have it, as long as it's your personal property. We seem to overlook that for some reason. Or when the Ten Commandments are either removed or not put into public spaces, we say we're being persecuted. We tend to lose here in the West and in the United States in particular some perspective on what Christians, our Christian brothers and sisters, are really suffering elsewhere in the world that does qualify as genuine infringement upon religious freedom. Some of it bordering on persecution, some of it outright persecution. And to my way of thinking, we tend to also trivialize real persecution when we whine so much in a culture where still 86% of the people in the United States nominally are Christian, and you can say whatever you want to. On any street corner, you can open your Bible and read it. You can meet with whomever you want to meet, wherever you want to meet, and you can do it all in the name of your religion, whatever it may be. Now, the U.S. Commission on the International Religious Freedom issued its annual report yesterday. Let's find out what they had to say. This is Preeta Bansal. She's chair of this commission. She says the new Iraq must permit religious liberty.
Making sure that freedom of thought, conscience, religion, and belief is enshrined in the Iraqi constitution is not about trying to impose American values. This is about recognizing international standards that many Muslim countries themselves have recognized.
Now, many Muslim countries have not recognized them, and that's why Iraq becomes a priority when it comes to this commission on religious freedom. Under Saddam Hussein, one could be a Christian. One could not proselytize, but one could be a Christian. In fact, some of Saddam Hussein's high-ranking officials were Christians. One in particular, his prime minister, was, if I'm not mistaken, a Coptic Christian. So you could be a Christian. Saddam Hussein claimed to be running a Muslim state, but most people looking in at Iraq before the U.S. invasion said, no, this is really a secular state being run speciously in the name of Islam. They questioned whether or not Saddam Hussein was a Muslim even himself, as much as he was perhaps a Marxist or a dictator. So the new Iraq needs religious freedom. And it's not just a matter of hoping for the best, it's a matter of enshrining it in its constitution, which is currently in the stages of formation. Now, Bansal says that Muslim nations shouldn't repress other faiths.
Protecting freedom of religion or belief is not un-Islamic.
Now, we had a guest on yesterday who would beg to differ. Dr. Alvin Schmidt yesterday said that Quran observant Muslims, if they follow their Quran, would not permit religious freedom. Conversions is really the issue here. Now, see, it's one thing to say you can be a Christian if you're already a Christian. But if you're a Muslim, you can't become a Christian on the pain of death, which is what exactly happens in a lot of Islamic states under Sharia law. Well, if you're already a Christian and you're willing to forego the possession of a Bible, the freedom of assembly with other Christians, or proselytizing, go ahead and be a Christian. But if you're a Muslim and you by hook or crook somehow are converted to Christianity, you can die. Nina Shea, vice chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, says that religious freedom doesn't exist in countries like, say, for instance, Saudi Arabia.
In the last month, 100 Christians have been detained, some for several hours or days. Some are reported to be still detained for holding a religious worship service in a private home in Riyadh.
Now, just contrast that with how I began this first section of open lines here. These people are being detained. As Dr. Alvin Schmidt pointed out yesterday, possessing a copy of the Bible is technically illegal in Saudi Arabia. And they're considered, by the way, one of the friendlier Muslim nations to us. Proselytizing is out of the question, and while the freedom of assembly is kind of an iffy issue in Saudi Arabia, apparently if you do assemble with other Christians for the purpose of a private worship service in your home, you can at the very least be detained. Kind of makes the whole whining about the baby Jesus in the manger at the public library lawn sound a little trivial. And you say, well, that's where it starts. That's where it starts. Perhaps. Or perhaps we've not been paying attention to what is genuine religious persecution. It's Open Lines Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to differ with me on this if you want to. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's Nina Shea again. She says that Saudi religious police imprison and torture non-Muslims.
The commission is recommending that the United States stop approving the export to Saudi Arabia of items such as thumb cuffs, leg irons, and shackles, which could be used by some of the Saudi agencies to perpetrate human rights violations, including torture.
Now, I think that qualifies as genuine persecution. How high a priority do you think this ought to be when we are constantly working to improve our relations with Muslim nations? It's obviously a priority in Iraq, where a new Muslim nation is forming and its constitution is taking shape. Religious freedom needs to be of the highest priority there so that we have a genuine constitutional democracy. But how high of a priority ought this to be? There are other priorities, of course. Terrorism is a huge priority. Trade in things like oil, a huge priority. You know, I was sitting with my daughter a couple weeks back. She's got a geography course, and they're just doing geography the old-fashioned way. They're pulling out the map. They're learning the names of the countries, the names of the cities, the landforms, the water bodies, you name it. We were studying the Near East, we sometimes call it the Middle East. All these countries, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya. What's life like? It's one thing to look down at a map and say, well, there they are. It's kind of a big sandbox with lots of oil underneath it and people taking advantage of that resource and that wealth. It's another thing to say, what's it like to actually live there? What's it like to live there if you're not a Muslim? This report is giving us some idea of what that's like. Now, Michael Cromarty, he's a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. He says that religious freedom includes the right even to proselytize.
The commission has consistently opposed and spoken out against countries that persecute people who change from one religion to the other. Now, the effect it has on missionaries is very important, because what you have is a lot of missionaries who are very courageous, who do proselytize in situations that put their own lives in danger.
Now, there are countries where you can proselytize. Now, this is not an Islamic nation, not entirely. Think of the modern state of Israel. You can proselytize to a certain degree. Now, can you convert? No. Well, let me put it to you this way. You can proselytize a Palestinian in the modern state of Israel, but it is illegal to proselytize a Jew in Israel. So even there, our dear friend on the borders of the Mediterranean, even there, religious freedom suffers. Finally, Michael Cromarty, he says that China, we've been talking about the Muslim nations, China is a pretty big Muslim nation, in fact. There's a lot of Muslims there. China remains among the world's worst violators of religious rights.
Religious freedom conditions in China continue to be poor. Prominent religious leaders and lay persons continue to be tortured, imprisoned, and subjected to other forms of ill treatment on account of their religion and their belief.
We hear about Falun Gong. It's a cult. There's no two ways about it. It's a crazy Chinese cult. But they run afoul of the state an awful lot in China. Should Christians be concerned about that? Yes, they're cult members. But the very same hand that sweeps them off the street for being members of that religion could sweep Christians off the street. House churches are still illegal in China. Many, many exist. We have no idea how many Christians there are in China. We have no way of knowing. Most of them are underground. If you'd like to react to this report from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, give us a call now. We've got about 10 minutes left in open lines here in the second 25 minutes of Issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know what it makes me think? This is what it makes me think before we go on to the next thing, which is somewhat related. I can still, this weekend, this is what I'm going to be doing. Get in my car. I'm going to have my clerical collar on. All the neighbors will see who I am and where I'm going. I can still pack up my robes, my Bible, jump in the car, drive a couple, well, an hour and a half south of here into southwest Missouri, southeast Missouri, and preach at two different churches. No one is going to stop me unless I exceed the speed limit. If they stop me, they're like, where are you going? What are you doing with that Bible? No, I can tell the, if I do get stopped, which I hope I don't, I can tell the police officer, I'm going to preach. I'm going to preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And when I get there, no one will knock the door down. I will come home safely. My family will have gone to church and heard someone else preach the same message in complete and utter freedom, for which we ought to be greatly thankful to our God that we enjoy, and this is, folks, unprecedented religious freedom in this country. As much as we whine about it, unprecedented religious freedom. Have we seen an increase in bias, do you think, and discrimination against Muslims since 9/11 here in the United States? There's this organization that we talk about quite often here, CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They think we have. Ibrahim Hooper, he's a spokesman for CARE, and he says that there's been a significant increase in discrimination against Muslim Americans.
The growing anti-Muslim rhetoric, which I personally think is the greatest factor in this, the hate radio, hate, anti-Muslim hate just proliferating on the internet.
Now, I wonder whether or not this program, the things that we've said here on this program over the last couple of years, the things that were said yesterday by Dr. Alvin Schmidt when we talked about Islam and its influence in the West, would qualify for Mr. Hooper as hate radio or as some sort of invective against Islam. I imagine he probably would consider it. Okay, here's the question. Is it an unfair representation of Islam to open the Quran, as Dr. Schmidt did yesterday, and say, look, here, look, chapter and verse. This is what it says. This is what many of the adherents to Islam believe. This is what I wonder. And not to give any credence whatsoever to those who have, and I think it's relatively few people, but those who have tried to stir up undue or mischaracterizations of Islam. Not to give any credence to that. But maybe what's happened since 9/11 is that we've paid more attention to this world religion, Islam, and that we're getting a clearer picture of it. Well, Ergun Kaner was on the program just a while ago, the new dean of the Theological Seminary at Liberty University and a regular guest on this program, a convert from Islam to Christianity. What is he saying? He's saying, this is what Islam was when I was in it. This is what Islam remains. He has great hopes for the moderation of Islam. But even he has been accused of being intolerant and derogatory toward Muslims. Here's Nihad Awad. He's executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE. He says that there's been an increase in anti-Islamic rhetoric in America.
Our community has been under attack by some media outlets and columnists trying to cast in dark light our community's loyalty and commitment to safety and security of this nation.
Now, I don't know about CARE's position on terrorism and the safety and security of this nation. This is the only question I have about CARE, the only one that really matters to me. And that is, are they fairly representing Islam? That's all I really am worried about. Now, if CARE is made up of moderate to liberal Muslims who say, yeah, we know what those people over there in Iran, what those people over there in Saudi Arabia make of Islam. That's not what we make of Islam. Then fine. Just tell us that. We are a moderating influence in what is otherwise mostly manifested as a pretty nasty religion. But we are a moderating influence. That I can deal with. What I have a harder time dealing with is organizations like CARE saying, we represent what Islam really is everywhere. Then, and they make a distinction which is perhaps less helpful than it sounds. You got Muslims and then you have Muslim fundamentalism. What did Dr. Schmidt say yesterday? He says that term Muslim fundamentalism is a red herring. It's misleading because it gives the impression that Islam in its essence is not what Muslim fundamentalism is, that somehow Muslim fundamentalism is Islam on steroids, Islam taken too seriously, Islam read too literally. If someone from CARE wants to say we're a moderating influence in a religion that needs reform, that is great. We should all be welcoming a small r reformation in Islam, if such a thing could happen. What do you think? Give us a call here in the next few minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Awad says that Muslim Americans shouldn't be linked to terrorism.
We have condemned consistently and categorically terrorism and especially 9/11.
All right, and I agree with him there completely. American Muslims, if they are peace-loving citizens, if they live in our society following the rules, if they are Americans, well, let's put it this way. If they are American Muslims rather than Muslim Americans, I'd say the same thing about Christians, American Christians rather than Christian Americans. If they are citizens like anyone else, they should not be linked to terrorism, not because of their religious beliefs. Now, what about the religion's link to terrorism? That's a different issue. You see, someone could say, look, I'm a Muslim American, and don't link me with the terrorists. I want nothing to do with those terrorists. Fine. Good. I agree. And I don't think you should be linked to it. But don't you think maybe your religion might feed the spirit of terrorism in the world? That's not linking any Muslims with any American Muslims, but it is raising the question about whether or not Islam itself is amenable to terrorism as we find it in the modern world. Finally, here's Arsalan Iftikhar. He is legal director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, and he says that one of the high profile bias complaints involved a popular singer. You'll remember this guy from the 70s.
Yusuf Islam, formerly known as Cat Stevens, was on a flight from London to Washington, D.C. in September of 2004 when his plane was turned around and diverted to Bangor International Airport in Maine. He was then questioned by Secret Service and FBI agents who summarily sent him back to London without, again, any explanation.
Now, if I don't, I might not be right about this, but I think that Cat Stevens, who became a convert to Islam, is an expatriate from the United States, not a citizen of the United States. So the whole issue of American Muslim doesn't really apply there. I think he's a citizen of Great Britain, if I'm not mistaken. But just today I heard it, this morning. A plane headed from France to Boston was diverted mid-flight from France to Bangor, Maine. That must be the processing center. Why? Because one person on board was on the no-fly list. Now, I didn't hear any more today of whether or not that name was a Muslim name. But does that represent a discrimination against someone or just a thoughtful caution? Especially if someone's on the no-fly list. I don't think Cat Stevens is on the no-fly list. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Coming up in about 10 minutes, Pastor George Borghardt will be our guest. We'll talk about Balaam's donkey. Pastor Clement Preuss joins us to talk about worship. Greg Kokel, our regular guest, he'll be telling us about how to respond to relativism in the culture, and Dr. Angus Manoj will join us to talk about intelligent design in some of our state's schools. Jerry calls from South County. Jerry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hi, Todd. First of all, I have a book called How Islam Plans to Change the World by William Wagner. But the thing that really gets me about Islam is if these if you live in a Muslim country or if Muslims take over any country, they actually want to force people to believe in their Allah God. That's not right. I mean, Jesus, he would never force anyone. In fact, we understand he chooses us. We don't choose him. And this forcing, and then it starts to be forcing by terrorism or torture if they're in control of that country. If they're not, oh, yeah, they're very peaceful. They have nothing to work with if they're just scattered all around and not really in control of the country. But if they are in control, they gang up on people and they harm them if they don't believe in their Allah God. You can't have free will and have that kind of a religion when you have free will.
Jerry, thank you for the call. Okay, now she's pointed out something that Dr. Montgomery, a regular guest on here on the program, Dr. John Borg Montgomery, has pointed out many times here, and that is just by observation, and he said this right after 9/11 on this program, just by observation, you can see that when Muslims are in the political minority in any nation, they tend to wax more moderate in their public persona, in their statements, in their activities. When they gain the political minority in a country, that moderation tends to disappear. Now, that is not, I don't think you can lay that at the doorstep of any individual Muslims. I think you can lay it at the doorstep of one thing, and that is the failure, and this came up yesterday with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, the failure in Islam. This is the key to understanding much of what's going on in the Islamic world. And what Jerry just said, the lack of a distinction in the Quran between the church and the state. You see, what would you expect of a religion that does not have a distinction between church and state? You would expect that when it's in the minority, it is, and it has no political power to speak of because it's in the minority, it doesn't get to have its way. When it's in the majority, of course, since there's no distinction between church and state, you know, a lot of Christians seem to believe this way about Christianity for some reason. When they're in the majority, then suddenly, well, what's the natural outcome? We're going to have our way. The other factor there is Sharia law, and it's related to the first thing I mentioned. You see, Sharia law isn't religious law. It isn't just holy law. It isn't just sacred law. It is civil law in Muslim nations. And it is civil law because there is no distinction between church and state. Another reason for Christians to give thanks for Romans chapter 13. When we come back, we'll talk about Balaam's donkey with Pastor George Borghardt.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.